Good afternoon, everybody. It's time for us to start. My name is Masha Chlanova, and I'm a lecturer here at MoMA. I'm also writing my dissertation right now on the Russian avant-garde and Malevich and Tatlin and two of the artists who I have done most work on. So feel free to ask me more detailed questions at the end. What this talk is about is the dialogue of these two leading figures of the Russian avant-garde. Can you hear me okay, or do you need, should I use the microphone?
Okay.
I can use the microphone. So this talk is dedicated to two of the best-known figures of the Russian avant-garde, Malevich and Tatlin. And one of the motivations, I guess, for this talk is to sort of remedy the imbalance that exists in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art, which is that we have a lot of works by Malevich, but we have nothing by Tatlin. And this is not because of any bias. It's simply because works by Tatlin are very rare, and very few of them have been preserved. And Alfred Barr, the first director and chief curator of MoMA, had made an effort to acquire Tatlin's works in the 1930s, at the same time when he was able to acquire a lot of Malevich's works in Germany. And he had asked, and this information, one can find it through the archives at MoMA, that Alfred Barr had asked Tatlin indirectly if he could give any works for his 1936 Cubism and Abstract Art Show. And Tatlin said that, well, in Moscow, Tatlin said, well, even though my work is not so well recognized right now, I'm sure it will be in a few decades, so I don't want to Russia to lose anything. Basically, that was his kind of attitude. And this attitude was very different from some of the other avant-garde artists, such as Rodchenko and Stepanova, for example, the famous figures also, who at the time in 1930s were destroying their early work because they thought that it wasn't needed by anybody anymore, that it was outdated. So when Alfred Barr's agents, or his friend, who was in Moscow, came to Rodchenko, they said, yes, of course, we will give you everything because it's really irrelevant at this point. If you want it, okay, we'll give it to you. So, you know, there was this difference in attitude. And Tatlin was certainly very stingy about whatever originals he had. Ironically, though, very few of his works have been preserved. And I will point to you, when I show you the reproductions, most of what we have are either documentary documentation of his works, early photographs, or reconstructions. And I will tell you as we go along which ones are these and where the existing works are. So it's not only MoMA's situation, it's a situation of many museums around the world. There just aren't so many Tatlins. So here are these two figures. Art historians have constructed a very stable and static opposition between these two figures. Usually Tatlin is seen as the forefather of constructivism, and Malevich as the founder of the movement called suprematism. And this opposition is very firm in art history, and this is what you hear in all the introductory art history courses. It is this kind of opposition. It stems back to the time of their own activity. These two figures have began their careers at the same time in the early 19-teens, and they have worked in parallel in an overlapping geographical and temporal space from the early 19-teens until the late 1920s and early 1930s. Yet their work is seen as going kind of in opposite directions from very early on, traditionally. And one early critic who has created this opposition is a very influential contemporary of these artists, Nikolai Punin, who wrote, "As long as I remember them, they always divided the world between themselves, the earth, the sky, and the interplanetary space, establishing everywhere the sphere of their influence. Tatlin claimed the earth for himself, trying to push Malevich into the sky for non-objectivity. Malevich didn't refuse the planets, but didn't cede the earth either, rightfully thinking that it is also a planet and therefore can be non-objective." So, you know, you have this kind of planet-earth, earth-sky opposition already. Another contemporary critic, Boris Arvatov, labeled Tatlin a materialist and Malevich an idealist. And more recently, an art historian named Vasily Rakitin called Tatlin the Artisan and Malevich the Prophet. So you see, you have this stable kind of opposition between the two artists. And there is very little literature, really. There is very little art historical literature on the relationship between their work, because usually you just kind of put the two arrows in two directions. And all there is maybe two or three short articles, a couple of them in Russian, one of them in English, that talk about mostly their rivalry and for the leadership of the Russian avant-garde, because they're such prominent figures. Yet what I will try to show in this talk is that there is a huge amount of aesthetic and historical information that is not covered by this traditional perception. And what I will try to show you is the degree to which these artists were involved with each other's projects, even though the relationship between them was that of a kind of hidden rivalry, yes, but not so much rivalry for the leadership as rivalry for a kind of artistic, deep, hidden connection that the two of them had. Because A, they came from the same artistic context, from the same interest and the same background, and I will show you this. B, their goals, their kind of deep artistic goals are very similar. And so they were seeing each other on the same level of potential, a little bit like Picasso and Matisse. If you're familiar with this, there was an exhibition here a few years ago of Picasso and Matisse kind of working against each other for years, decades, against and in parallel. So it's a little bit similar. And then what is also important is that the intensity of this rivalry between these artists created this power field, kind of this electrified space within which a lot of the other artists of the avant-garde were working. So what I will try to show you also is that, say, constructivism comes out of a combination of these two, what these artists did, rather than just one or the other. So, you know, you will see there's a lot we can do or try to do today. So this is where these artists start, in the early 19-teens. And you have two early self-portraits which show you visually where they come from. Just to give you a little bit of historical background, Russia in the first two decades of the 20th century is probably at its most open and its most intense development, artistically as well as economically, as well as politically. And artists have access to the most advanced Western European art. They travel to Europe, many of them at least, and then there are big collections of the most advanced French or other European modernism in Moscow and in St. Petersburg that artists have access to, and there are many publications that they have access to. So it's probably the most open moment in the history of Russian art, these first two decades. And what you can see in this work already, the self-portrait by Malevich here shows you, and you can probably see this being familiar with with Gauguin, for example, or with symbolist painting, that he's absorbing a lot of these trends and trying to really develop his own style. At the same time, Tatlin's work here on the right, he shows himself as a sailor, and he did work as a sailor. He studied in the Marine Academy, and he worked as a sailor for a couple of years when he ran away and became an artist. He shows himself as a sailor, but what you can also see in his style, and it's probably a little bit harder to, but you just have to take my word for it, he studied with someone who was really the grandfather of Russian avant-garde, Larionov, Mikhail Larionov, who was the founder of the so-called primitivism. The main point for us here is that this primitivism was grounded in the Russian tradition, trying to find a Russian own Russian language. And you will see this in the next work that I show you by Tatlin and Malevich, from only a couple of years later. This work by Tatlin, you can see it is based on a Russian icon, right? It's called Madonna, and it's clearly based on a Madonna and child. Icons were something that was a traditional Russian source that avant-garde artists discovered in the early 1910s. In that same year, 1913, there was a huge retrospective of icons that were perceived as modern visual sources that were authentically Russian, not Western. Matisse is one of the artists who comes to Moscow in 1911 and is fascinated by icons and says, well, this is the most modern thing you guys could have come up with. and I've learned, I have something to learn from Russia as well. In any case, Tatlin, you can see here, is looking at an icon. But then what is he doing visually with it? He's analyzing, it's also called a study for composition analysis, this work. So he's analyzing the composition in a very cubist kind of way, right? If you look at the Malevich on the left, the Cowan violin, an early work also from 1913, you can see that Malevich very much also comes out of cubism, French cubism of Braque and Picasso. And you know, MoMA's collection is rich in cubist works, so you're welcome to come at any point to the fifth floor and check all these collages and early analytic cubist paintings. They have these broken planes superimposed on each other. And basically what cubism does, it analyzes space and three-dimensionality into its kind, analyzes its structure, its underlying structure. So that's clearly what Tatlin does, reducing the visual representation to the main elements. Instead of giving us a coherent picture of a kind of photographically represented world, cubism instead reduces the visual language to the minimal, to the minimum, to the analyzing it. So that's why it's this early phase of cubism is called analytic. So you see the lines, for example, that create a sense of volume and create a sense of depth. And in Malevich, you can see that he's using these planes also that are disjointed. So this is cubism. French cubism is one point in common that Malevich and Tatlin have. And it's one very strong umbilical cord, we can say, that unites them throughout their artistic projects. It's something that they seek to overpass, both of them, throughout their careers, and it's something that they have an intense competition about. Who is going to be better at breaking with the French and doing something new? There is another source that they share in common, a specifically Russian source, but also a trait of modernism in Europe more generally. And this is, we will come back to the Malevich, but let me show you one more point about cubism and how intense cubism is for both of them. In 1913, Tatlin has his studio in Moscow, and in his studio, two women artists, Popova and Udaltsova, two women artists, come back from Paris where they studied cubism, and they found a cubist circle in Tatlin's studio. And Malevich comes to that studio to learn or to draw and to paint. And what I'm showing you on the right is a typical cubist work from this period, the Picasso's analytic cubist painting. I'm sure you can see, if you look, you can see the connection with the Madonna. Can you? Yeah. And on the left is a drawing that Tatlin made. It's a portrait of Malevich, this one, in a very clearly cubist style, in an oval shape, a typical cubist oval shape, with this mustache and the double chin that are repeated separately. And this, what does it show us already from this very start? That Tatlin A shows that he can paint in a cubist, draw in a cubist style, that he masters it quite well, and B, that he also connects Malevich with that style. Because, well, I can see, and everybody can see, that you and I are now into cubism, kind of like this. What we know is, we know of another work from this period, not this particular drawing, but another drawing by Tatlin in a cubist style, on which Malevich has written at the back, "Tatlin has learned cubism from me." And then he gives him a grade of B. So he thinks he wasn't so good. This tells us something about the kind of relationship these two artists have from that start, when they're just coming out on the scene. And we know that it's a hoax, that, you know, Tatlin never learned cubism from Malevich. Neither did really Malevich learn from Tatlin, but they are sharing that space, and they're competing over that shared space already. And the second important connection between these two artists is the so-called trans-rational poetry. In Russian, it is called Zaum poetry. Za, a prefix for being beyond, for rational or reason. So this poetry that came from the Russian context was guided by two poets. One is Alexei Krucholek, who you can see here, and this is Malevich, and it's another artist, Alexei Matushin, also an artist of the avant-garde, but also a musician. And the second poet, who was a founder of the Zaun transrational poetry, was Vladimir Khlebnikov. So these two figures, Khlebnikov and Krucholek, these two poets, are the heroes for both Malevich and Tatlin, and for many other Russian avant-garde artists as well, but especially for Malevich and Tatlin, because what Zaun poetry does, what it seeks to do, is very similar to their aspirations. What it does, in a nutshell, of course, it's a whole big subject. It's a very famous kind of avant-garde poetry. But what they want to do, when they publish a manifesto in 1911, they publish a manifesto called The Word as Such, The Letter as Such. What they want to show is they want to emphasize the texture or the visual appearance of the words of language and separate it from the content or meaning. At least, I hope it will make more sense as we go along. I will show you more examples. But it's the idea of breaking the conventions of if it looks like a dog, then it means a dog. And this is what Malevich does here. When he puts, why would he put a violin and a cow, put a cow on top of a violin? He seeks to find a visual equivalent to something that transrational poetry does. It breaks our concepts by juxtaposing, by putting a very realistic-looking cow, right, photographic-looking cow, on a very legible violin. But then what are we to make of this? What is the subject matter of that painting? What is the whole point? So what he seeks to do is a little bit what these poets seek to do at the beginning, is they break our expectations. So they make us really think, okay, so what is this really about? And what is there underneath? And we'll come back to these paintings that Malevich makes in a moment. He, in 1913, he's very directly involved with these two figures, Krucholek and this other artist, and they stage an opera, Victory Over the Sun, a futurist opera. Victory Over the Sun gives you an idea of this, the ambition, this, the degree of their ambition, right? It's about the figures conquering the sun and kind of coming out in a new era. How much more, you know, grand scale can I get? And these are the designs that Malevich made for the stage. He did the stage design, the stage sets design. This commentary in Russian, which says foolish, tells us something about the state of confidence that Malevich was in. I mean, this is not to make a generalized conclusion, but he certainly is experimenting at this point. This is the curtain where the sun is setting. So you have half of it is dark, half of it is light. And it's still representational. It's not completely abstract, but it looks pretty abstract. So already in 1913, Malevich has this direct connection to the transrational poets. And these are the kinds of paintings, along with the cow and violin, that he makes in these years. In 1914, the work on the right is in MoMA's collection. It's on the fifth floor, reservist of the first division. And the work on the left, composition with Mona Lisa, this says partial eclipse. And then this says apartment for rent. This says Thursday, tobacco box. Kind of random words, or seemingly random words. The visually, it's also pretty chaotic, isn't it? Malevich calls them allogical paintings, or non-logical paintings. And when he exhibits them in 1915, he accompanies them with an inscription that says, "The content of the works is unknown to the author." So, you know, there's this drive to get to something that is beyond and above and beyond our reasonable understanding of things, our conscious or automatic association. If it looks like that, then it is like that. We of course try to put it together and try to see what is this? Is that, okay, we can see a face. We always try to put a composition together, but it doesn't really come together. And he blocks the information with his flat planes of color just where we most expect it. We would like a face here. We see an ear, we see a hat, we see a profile, we want a face. Or we want maybe at least a hand. If this is a cuff, a handcuff, then we want a hand. None of that we get, right? So there is a kind of displacement of what we expect from what we see. And when he says content of the works is unknown to the author, he tries to say, well, there's more to painting than you can see, among other things. So this is the connection that Malevich establishes with the transrational poetry. And still, it reminds us of the Cubist collage, or of the Cubist styles, right, that we saw with the earlier work, the Cowit Violin. Well, Tatlin, of course, knows of these works, and he is not losing time either. In 1914, and I'm showing you two Picassos here, the reason for this is that in 1914, Tatlin goes to Paris. He manages to travel not as an artist, but as a player of this national Ukrainian instrument, bandura, the string instrument. He goes to Berlin with some kind of exhibition, gets somebody to sponsor him, and then he sneaks out, takes a train to Paris, and sneaks into Picasso's studio as a potential studio assistant or something like this. This is in the spring of 1914. Picasso, of course, once he discovers he's an artist, so he was a very clever, of course, artist, and he doesn't make much of him, and he kind of makes fun of him a little bit, and Tatlin says, well, we Russians will find our own way. You know, so what he sees in Picasso's studio is important. So those types of constructions, and this is a photograph from the period, from 1914. These works have not been preserved. There is a guitar at MoMA, in MoMA's collection, but those kinds of three-dimensional constructions on the wall, and you can see the paper support on the wall. These are what Tatlin would have seen in Picasso's studio, or works like this, also from just before that, from 1913. So when Tatlin comes back to Moscow with his big ambition of doing his own thing, he comes back at the end, I think beginning of April 1914, at the beginning of May, within a month, he has an exhibition in his studio. Remember the same studio where he had the Cubist circle? He has an exhibition of these works that he calls reliefs. And these reliefs, as you see, are both photographs. They have not been preserved. In fact, we don't have any record of the original ones that he showed in 1914. We know that this work, called the bottle, well, painterly relief, really, it's what they're called. Bottle is a kind of reference word. This was shown in December 1914, and this is early 1915. But they look more or less the same as what the early works. The bottle can also be seen on both sides, kind of flipped 180 degrees, which tells you that Tatlin is not so concerned about it looking as a bottle or as a glass, very typical Cubist move also. Mm-hmm. But he is more concerned about the materials, and this is what he announced. It's called a painterly relief. What he's more interested in, and the materials you can see listed here, are typical collage materials, also wallpaper, a sheet of metal, another sheet of metal, some wires. He is interested in materials. He's interested in the texture. What he says his works seek to do is they seek to bring out the texture and the materials, and they follow the materials. What the materials dictate, Tatlin says, is what I make my work into. So if you think back to the transrational poetry who emphasized the word as such, and the texture of the word, and the appearance of the word, and the sound of the word, a typical transrational poem would sound something like something nonsensical. They invented a new language. What they tried to do is, with these liberated words and sounds, they would make a new, more universal language. This, if you're familiar, there was Dada poetry, there was Futurist poetry at the time, and this is very close in the appearance of what they're doing. There are subtle differences also between their projects, the Russian project or the Italian project, the German project. And we don't, unfortunately, have time now to go into the details, but what matters for us is that for these artists, it's the Russians who are the background and their connection for Tatlin and Malevich. So what Tatlin does for this work, he brings it to an exhibition in December 1915. He brings it 2 hours before the opening, and he makes a big scandal with it. The organizers try to take it away, to withdraw it from the exhibition. Then they're forced to put it back in somehow. or they decide to put it back in, and it attracts a lot of attention of the press. And Tatlin immediately makes a big name for himself. This work in 1915, but this story of the bottle tells you something about the kind of unexpectedness, the degree to which this was way beyond what anybody could have expected at the time. This work on the right, a painterly relief or assemblage of materials. This is also what Tatlin calls his work, assemblage of materials. It's made of a piece of glass, cast iron, plaster, tar. So you can imagine, you have to use your imagination with these, unfortunately, we don't have them. They begin to come out in three dimensions, really. And this is already completely non-referential, if you think about it. It's completely abstract. It doesn't have any reference to the outside world. It's not an image of anything in particular. It doesn't even have a slight reference like the bottle would. So it's out there, going beyond cubism, in that cubism never gave away, never gave up. Neither Braque nor Picasso never gave up reference to the outside world and never went into complete abstraction. They stopped short, always. It was always a bottle or a violin, no matter how difficult it looked. It always was a reference. Well, here, Tatlin breaks with cubism, and this is a big statement that he makes already in the spring of 1914. What he also does at the same exhibition in the spring of 1914, he invites a poet, and unfortunately I can't find his name right now, but he invites a poet who reads post-Zaum poetry, post-transrational poetry. So what he claims to do at the same time, he claims to go beyond the transrational poetry as well. I haven't been able to find exactly what it was like, that poetry. But what matters to us is this intention. Tatlin comes out to the public as somebody who bypassed cubism and who went beyond the transrational poetry. So Malevich, you can imagine, must have been quite excited about this. But he also must have felt that he had been bypassed in his goals as well. This is another example of what Tatlin's work looked like, and this is one that is preserved. It's at the Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow, and the photo is in the gallery, so you can see some other works there. And it gives you a slightly better idea of what they look like in color. They still have this traditional support of the wall, which will disappear soon. And this is from 1916, but it's just also giving you an idea of what these works look like. So 1915 is the moment when Malevich and Tatlin both come out triumphantly. It's also a very important moment for the history of Russian avant-garde. It's a moment of self-definition, of coming of age, if you want. The moment when the many Russian artists really feel like they stop absorbing others' achievements and they really come out on their own. And the exhibition, this exhibition, it's the December 1915 to January 1916 in Petrograd. It's the so-called 010 exhibition. This was also the moment when the project of Malevich and Tatlin came the closest, or at least they saw each other. They were forced to be in the same space. They didn't want to exhibit together. But the organizers said, no, if one of you is there, the other has to be. I said, well, we can't deal with this. So they found a compromise. They divided the exhibition into two rooms. So what Malevich showed was, and this is a famous photograph, it's the first public exhibition of suprematism, of abstract language that Malevich comes up with as a response to Tatlin's fame in 1914, or, you know, independently, but as a response, certainly within the context of our discussion here. And given that I've shown you how much Tatlin had accomplished by 1914. So Malevich shows his non-representational works, and you can see they're all completely abstract. It's presided by the black square. And he puts an inscription that says supremacy of painting. A better translation of suprematism is supremacy, which also implies dominance, right? Which also tells us something about Malevich's drive to kind of be the first one out there, the most important. And when Malevich brings this inscription, and they both do it very last minute before the opening, they're very afraid, both Malevich and Tatlin, that the other one will sneak in what they're doing. And so when they bring in this inscription, supremacy of painting, Tatlin and his followers, several of his friends, come up with an inscription, professional artists, and they put it up. So then Malevich didn't like that very much, and there was a fist fight directly. And so that our others had to calm them. But there's this whole, you know, there's this whole drama around that moment, which we don't know so much about usually. And the Tatlin's works, you can see this is a corner counter relief. This is where, as I told you, he breaks with the support. There is no more flat surface that holds the work. It comes out in three dimensions. So he calls it corner counter relief. Counter relief. He started with reliefs, right? Then they become counter reliefs to reinforce it. Counter meant reinforced, really huge relief. And then he puts them in a corner, in three-dimensional space. So what they're no longer far from being on a flat surface. They're not only in relief, but they're completely within the architectural space. And the architectural space becomes part of the work itself. You can see how painstakingly Tatlin had put these white pieces of paper around to serve as the background or as the ground for the work. This is another work with a leg of a chair. And this is completely non-representational, again. What Malevich does with his suprematism in 1915, he again makes a direct connection to his involvement with Zaun poetry. And he says, well, now I found a pictorial, he doesn't name it like this openly, but underlying really is that he found a pictorial equivalent for what transrational poets were trying to do, mainly to liberate the language, the texture, the visual language of painting from any reference to the outside world, and to give it thereby to give it a more universal and more ambitious spin, really. Because what he says, his black square, and this is the original black square from 1915 that is in the collection of the Tretyakov Gallery that you rarely see reproductions of. Usually, you know, usually if you have a lecture on Malevich, people show you, most often at least, people show you these very nice smooth surfaces. Well, the original is all cracked up, and it cracked. The craquelures appeared in the first year, and they did an X-ray of this painting about 15 years ago. And there is a composition underneath. You can see a colorful composition, something like this. So that when, and it was hung in the corner. Also, there is this called just another little anecdote. Yes.
The painting you just showed, black square, is that it?
Yes. Yes. That's the one that was shown in 1915. Malevich did three more versions of it in the years after. And often scholars confuse which one's which, but this is the original. That's at the Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow. One scholar of Tatlin, and this is another anecdote that will just give you an idea of how this whole kind of scene has played out in history. Anatoly Strigalev, who is the foremost expert on Tatlin, has argued that Malevich had seen Tatlin put his corner counter-relief in a corner, and that gave him an idea to put the painting in the corner. Well, you know, we could believe that or not. He's convinced, and he is a big authority. Another idea that has been suggested is that this refers to the placement of a Russian icon in a traditional peasant house in a corner, the so-called red corner. Red in Russian meaning also beautiful, not only the, you know, the communist red, but the beautiful, it's the same word. And so it's a kind of sacred space, and the space is presided by the work. So, you know, importantly for us, and I've told you that these two figures have played a major role in the history of 20th century art beyond Russian borders. Those things, you know, to me at least it makes me think of Richard Serra, you know, if you have seen the exhibition, and how his works are part of the architectural space. Well, this is 1915. Right, this kind of placement and the impact, the degree of the impact that suprematism had on post-war art, on artists later on, including many American modern artists, is immense. But it's interesting to see how, you know, what exactly they meant at the time. Here, let's come back to this. What Malevich does, he traces a direct connection to his designs from 1913. His stage set designs for the Futurist Opera with the transrational poets. And he says, well, this is when I invented abstraction, in 1913, i.e. before Tatlin, right? So Tatlin begins to publish his reliefs saying, season, artistic season, 1913-14. and these things have been propagated. You open a book on Tatlin or Malevich, you see these random dates. They have backdated the works. It's been this kind of never-ending strive during their lives. But I think it gives us an interesting dimension that we are not often aware of. We think, oh, an influence of one artist on another, or this one was first or this one was second. But how much there is at stake for these artists, and how much this kind of approach gives us a different kind of understanding, and maybe hopefully richer understanding. So what Malevich does, he traces this back. But we remember this word foolish right at the time, so that kind of shows us how confident was he of this semi-abstraction. And it's interesting that he hasn't scraped it off. I mean, he could have from reproductions, he hasn't. What suprematism does, and you can see these are typical suprematist paintings, both of these are in the, sorry, I can flip it back, both of these are in, here's one in that original exhibition. This is at MoMA, this one, Airplane Flying. Yeah, this one you can see on the fifth floor. This one is in Stedelijk. Stedelijk has probably the best collection also of Malevich outside of Russia. And so what is Malevich's goal? Yes?
The supremacist painting, that, of course, it's abstract, but what else, you know, what else can you say about
it? That's what I was about to get to. What Malevich claims, he publishes a manifesto at the same time as this exhibition opens. And he says, there's a famous quote from that manifesto, "I transformed myself in this era of form, and I went beyond the ring of the horizon. The horizon ring that traps the artist and the forms of nature." So what he claims to have done, first you have the zero of form. And of course, this is the originary moment. Oops. Yeah, this is the moment of origin. A constructed moment of origin, as we know, because there is a composition underneath. But he constructs it quickly as the beginning. And so he calls this the reigning royal infant. Again, you know. There's this kind of pathos is a typical modern.
Huh? Very purple language.
Yes. Well, he was very serious. I mean, these guys are extremely serious about their projects. They are breaking out there into the cosmos, you know, and into the new universe and universal language and all of that. That's why it's so important that they're first, also. But what he claims is these are pure forms of painting that are floating out in the infinite space. How easy is it to read it from the way it looks? Well, not so easy, right? But what he claims for these, and this, you notice, is Airplane Flying. It still has a reference to the world out there. But this is just called suprematist painting. Most of these are called suprematist paintings. The white space is coded as infinity for Malevich. And then what he claims to have done, and now if you think it's similar to what the transrational poets claim to have done, he emphasizes the form, drops the content, certainly the referential content. And this, if you think back to those allogical paintings, where the content of the work is unknown to the author. Well, now he claims that with this language, it no longer refers to anything outside at all, but it has its own, it constructs these forms out there in the infinite space, create a new universe, kind of. Now, one way to put it. But then what does it look like to us, visually? It still looks like cubist collage a little bit, doesn't it? Or these are geometric shapes on a flat surface, floating, one on top of the other. Cubist collage is never completely non-referential, but these works are okay, but still, there is a connection. And this is just to show you a bigger picture with these works in them, in it. And these are some other suprematist works that are less familiar, but also very much part of it, where he has these planes that are dissolving into the infinite space. So there is this whole emphasis on the dematerialization of this space, of kind of really... sorry, and just for a second, this is the culmination of suprematism. This is the high point where, and this work on the left is here at MoMA, also on the fifth floor, probably one of the best known works. This is the epitome of the movement, and this again is a Stedelijk. You can see how these planes are dissolving into infinity, and how he reduces completely to not even color. So there's just a sense of a figure and the ground still, but a sense of dynamism, a sense of movement, and a sense of that there is, the painting is reduced to almost nothing. Well, logically, this was the end of suprematism. It is said that he exhibited primed canvases on the ceiling in 1920. This is, we don't have documentation, but scholars have convincingly argued for that. He just turned to theoretical treatises, to teaching, and to other kinds of work I'll show you in a minute. But look at Tatlin's reaction. Tatlin's immediate reaction to to Milevich's suprematism. This is 1916. Tatlin, as you remember, with the reliefs, has completely stopped painting on two dimensions, and he never painted in two dimensions anymore, except for these two works, which haven't really been accounted for quite. But within this context, they make sense, I think, because if you see how much reference they have to suprematism, right, this dissolving plane, but yet they also look very, very cubist, again. So one way to understand these works is to think, well, he is putting Malevich back into suprematism, I mean, back into cubism, in the same way that he was putting him back into cubism in that little drawing, that oval drawing. He never says it openly, but for Malevich, who was very attuned, it would have been pretty clear, or for other artists as well. What he also does with these works, he also synthesizes suprematism and what Tatlin's project into one. And the important implication for this, for many other artists like Rodchenko or Lissitzky, is that later avant-garde really comes out of both projects, not one or the other, but both projects and the potential that they had in common, the potential that they shared. You see that the letters are typical of what Cubist collage does. This is called Month of May. This is the letter, the street, the address of Tatlin's studio. He shows these works in an exhibition he himself organized, and he forbid Malevich from exhibiting there as the organizer. At least he didn't allow him to exhibit suprematist works. He only allowed him to exhibit early allogical paintings. This is what Malevich is up to later with his students when he's teaching. This is what, I'm going to skip this because we're running out of time. This is what Tatlin does, because Tatlin mostly is not painting, except for that those two works in 1916. He makes a tower for which he's famous. He makes these objects for the new everyday life. And there's one more moment that I want to finish with. There's one more moment where there are two projects come very close. 1923, when Khlebnikov, the hero for both of them, the future, this poet, the Zaun poet, the transrational poet, died, Tatlin emphasized his own connection, strong connection and friendship with him. And he staged his so-called super story, or his poem, his Zaun poem, Zangezi. He staged it at the State Theater for the Arts, where State Institute for the Arts, Ginhuk in Russian, where both Malevich and Tatlin are teaching at the time in Petrograd. Tatlin stages a poem, and you can see Tatlin himself on top as the main hero of the play. You can see some letters written of that language, bar, bur, bur, chim, you know. And then you can see the students of Tatlin on this vertical stage, and this is stage design. You can see it looks very much like Tatlin's reliefs, right, with these wooden surfaces and these different planes. And this is the only work like this that we have preserved in a private collection in Germany. It's one of those surfaces. Tatlin made 60 surfaces that each signified the letters of the astral alphabet of this poet. And this is an exhibition of these surfaces. This is a documentary photograph. So you see ha, ka, ka, mu, go. This was go. But isn't it striking how much it looks like a suprematist painting? Or at least, probably Malevich would not have used the colors. But it's a non-referential, non-representational, abstract work. It's on a wooden surface, though. And it stands for a letter. And Tatlin, again, in 1923, can say, well, you know, this is a language that makes sense to me also. And he emphasizes different, he emphasizes the texture, just like the texture of the word. He emphasizes its symbolic significance. It's a little bit different, but again, he comes very close to Malevich's project. He really incorporates it into his own. Malevich is furious. He's teaching in the same institute. He doesn't allow his students to go see the play. And he becomes like little children sometimes, you know. And then he writes an article afterwards, not about the play, but about the poem itself, saying that, well, this is not the best of Chlebnikov's, and after all, Chlebnikov is not really the poet. The poet is Kruchonov, who's the other guy that I worked with in 1930. He doesn't say it so openly. But, you know, to tell you, to give you another example of this high moment. So, unfortunately, we are running out of time. And so, this, I hope, has given you a general idea of how much their projects are connected and how much it's in the overlap between the two. We can see how the degree to which they propelled each other, really. They were considering each other, and they were, by seeing the other getting somewhere, they were forced to make a move themselves. So it's a very constructive, even though painful, kind of rivalry. It's one of the motors for creativity that we seldom consider, in our history, but it's very important. We know also that, for example, when Tatlin died, he had an archive in his archive when he died. He had articles on Malevich. Everything was underlined. Everything that had to do with Malevich from his entire lifespan was underlined and collected. And he only had done it for Picasso, in addition to Tatlin, to Malevich. So it gives you an idea of how important these two figures were for each other. So this is all I had to say. If you have a couple of questions, we can still take 2 minutes at most, maybe. Yes?
Well, a lot of this is new because in my mind, Tatlin was a constructivist or sculptor, and somehow self-destructing sculpture. Maybe I have it wrong, but you haven't shown us very many of those. So you're trying to compare just his flat work, so to speak, or his paintings with Malevich, right?
He hasn't made any sculptures except for this tower, which he's very known for. Most of his works are the reliefs that I showed you, and the three-dimensional counter reliefs. They have been made. This is the image that we have of him as the founder of constructivism. But he hasn't made works that are directly. This is what constructivists, especially in outside of Russia, have made of him. So this is really, I'm just saying true to what he has done.
This representation in the West.
Well, it's a historical, it's a history of how the reception has developed and what has been more important. Also because there aren't so many works around.
His famous for being constructivist, but
he never was a constructivist. He never identified with constructivism himself. That he's known as a constructivist? Well, because the principles. And this we would have to have a separate talk on constructivism. But the principles of constructivism are based or derived from, are derived from the principles of his reliefs, which is that it's about the materials dictating the form of the work. It's about the materials themselves and their properties. This is what constructivists are about, Russian constructivists. But Russian constructivists, beginning with 1921, come out of the work of both Malevich and Tatlin. Lissitzky is at the Malevich student. Rodchenko makes his black-on-black paintings in reaction to Malevich's white-on-white before he makes his constructions. We have to understand that, this is something that's it's kind of a gap in history because I can go on forever about this, but constructivism has been known in the West through mediators often, through Pevsner and Gabor, who were not really in Russia at the time. It has been received in a certain way, but there is still more to do, to understand it. Okay, well, thank you very much. If you have more questions, I'll be here.